everyone, and welcome to our webinar for life insurance mutuals. If I can start by introducing our speakers this afternoon. First of all, we have John Gilbert, who is a consultant and former partner of the firm. John, as many of you will know, is a leading expert on friendly societies and life insurance mutuals and was heavily involved in Project Chrysalis. Jonathan Russell is a senior associate in our corporate practice. Jonathan focuses on the insurance industry and has considerable expertise in M&A in the insurance industry and the transfers of insurance business under Part 7 of the Financial Services and Markets Act and under the Friendly Societies Act. My name is Charles Ricks. I've advised insurance businesses for over 20 years on a range of M&A and regulatory matters. Now, I'll be covering three topics in today's webinar. I will start by talking about the Brexit process and its impact on life insurance mutuals. John Gilbert will then talk about mutual deferred shares, and Jonathan will then talk about developments in insurance industry M&A. Now, I expect that the Brexit process is well known to most of you. The process is triggered by the service of a notice under Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, and if new arrangements are not agreed within 2 years of service of the Article 50 notice, the EU treaties will cease to apply to the UK and our relationship with the European Union will be governed by World Trade Organization rules in the absence of other agreement. Our view is that the service of the Article 50 notice is a matter for the UK. Our view is that our hand cannot be forced on that. But clearly a long period of uncertainty is in no one's interests. From a regulatory perspective, UK businesses must continue to comply with UK regulations as enforced today, including applicable EU law. Now, I suspect the high-level issues are also relatively well known, at least as they affect the UK financial services and insurance businesses in the UK. And the starting point there, the focus has been very much on the need for UK firms to continue to be able to passport within the European Union to the extent that they have businesses within continental Europe. Now, it's difficult to separate that issue from a key issue for the European Union, which is freedom of movement, and the issues with net immigration into the UK highlighted by the referendum. But as I say, passporting is not an issue for all firms. We should remember as well that EEA firms will themselves want access to the UK markets, so the negotiation on passporting may not be simply one way. Moving on to Solvency II equivalence, our view there is that the UK is likely to want to maintain equivalent status for Solvency II purposes. That would mean continue to comply with Solvency II. But that said, equivalence is not an issue for UK businesses. It is only an issue for UK businesses that operate in the UK. And there are obviously a number of UK insurance companies with little or no business in the EU. As the Association of Financial Mutuals has pointed out, there is scope for a two-tier regulatory system in the UK with a system equivalent to Solvency II regime for those with international businesses and a separate system for those with UK domestic businesses. So what might the UK agree? I've set out four options here on this slide. I'm not going to go into these in any detail. Again, they've been covered quite significantly in press. There is the Norwegian model, where access to the EEA market has been retained, but freedom of movement is permitted within Norway. With the Swiss model, which is slightly different based on a range of cooperation agreements. And then at the bottom, of course, there is simple reliance on World Trade Organization rules. Exactly what we end up with, we'll have to wait and see. And it may well be that none of those models will apply to us. The UK is somewhat different to Norway and Switzerland, not just in terms of population. But the question we get fairly frequently from clients right now is, what should you be doing right now? Our view for the moment is that the focus should be on contingency plans, assessing the impact, identifying priorities arising from Brexit, and also some engagement in lobbying. And in fact, the impression we have is that the UK government is very open to this, they're in fact possibly encouraging it to get views from businesses on what Brexit should look like for UK PLC. There is also, our impression is that there is a lack of capacity and experience for negotiation within the government for this sort of thing, and that they will be looking to UK businesses to assist and point out the issues that they should be taking in the negotiation. Now, a further question we've had in this area is the effect of the Article 50 notice. And there is a view that this may well be, if you like, the starting gun for actual restructuring. And the reason for that is the time period it would take for a UK business with businesses around continental Europe to restructure, get the necessary permissions to conduct business, implement a transfer process, and do due diligence and discuss the restructuring with regulators. Now, that issue may be mitigated by two things. First is agreement by the UK with the EU in relation to transition arrangements, which would apply at the end of the two-year period, which is started by the Article 50 notice. Now, that would be in interest of both UK businesses and continental European businesses. And these arrangements would effectively allow those businesses to implement restructuring after the two-year period has ended. The other point that would be necessary in relation to those transition arrangements would be continuation of passporting rights for a period after the two-year period has ended. And if those two factors can be included alongside the service of the Article 50 notice, then perhaps service of the notice would not operate as a starting gun for restructuring. So let's take a look at the restructuring options for UK insurers. And in the first two bullets, I've set out two very basic options. One is to effectively establish a new EEA insurer with passporting rights, which would sit alongside an existing UK insurer. And essentially, what you would do is move the passporting rights from the UK insurer to the EEA insurer and operate in continental Europe through the new EEA insurer. So you'd have two companies rather than one in your structure. An alternative to that is to have an EEA insurer with passporting rights with a UK branch authorised to conduct insurance business in the UK. And in the second model, you obviously have one company, but your original UK company will have disappeared in effect. Now, those two options both have advantages and disadvantages. The first option, with the two company structure, UK insurer and the EEA insurer, is likely to be less capital efficient than the second option, which only involves one company. The disadvantage with the one company model in the second bullet in the slide is what we sometimes refer to as the double green light effect, which can arise in relation to a company with multiple branches around the European Union. And that arises where the business of the various branches operating around the European Union are reasonably significant, and for the company to do anything in any jurisdiction, it effectively needs the approval of two or perhaps even more regulators to undertake whatever activity it wants to do. Generally, we find that branch structures tend to work best when the branches themselves are relatively small. The next question, then, is how would restructuring be undertaken? There are various options, but probably the most popular is Part 7 of the Financial Services and Markets Act. There is another option, which is to convert to a European company, or Societas Europaea, and that's likely to be an option if you are going down the route of having a UK branch with an EEA insurer. So how does a European company model work? In effect, what you would do is convert your UK insurer into a European company, and when Brexit was looming, you would move your European company into an EU jurisdiction, say, for example, Ireland. And that is permitted under European law. It's simply a matter of changing the company's registered office. And the advantage of the European company approach to restructuring is that there is no need to move business between companies, which obviously involves a degree of due diligence to check how the transfer of the business interacts with the relevant transfer process you're using, and also to undertake a degree of due diligence in advance of that process. The point to remember, though, with the European company approach to restructuring is that you still need to obtain the relevant authorizations or permissions in the relevant jurisdiction, in other words, the country to which you are moving the European company. But in terms of timetable, there is probably no advantage in using a European company, but there is an advantage in using this approach in that you don't need to move business between companies in order to achieve your restructuring. Now, the final point on this slide is that some restructuring mechanisms may only be available until Brexit, and the European company model is, of course, one of them. It is a matter of European law, and also the cross-border merger process, which would fall away on Brexit if there were no transitional arrangements agreed. But there are some mechanisms which will be available post-Brexit, and Part 7 is one of those, and that's part of UK legislation. But the point to remember there is that recognition of a UK court order made on a Part 7 transfer may be an issue. I like to think that that wouldn't be too much of an issue, given that we've had recognition of UK judgments around Europe now for some time. Let's take a look now at the impact on existing business operations. We've seen a number of issues arising in the lead up to the referendum and also after the referendum vote. There's been an impact on the value of investments held by insurance companies, and some have also recalculated technical provisions and capital requirements, mainly to reflect lower interest rates. One point we've seen relates to termination rights. We've seen some termination and collateral provisions being triggered as a result of the referendum vote. That really arises from the impact that the referendum vote has had on financial covenants and changes made in ratings of companies by rating agencies. But by and large, those are probably the exception, as I said, rather than the rule, if you like. Similarly, we've seen some contracts with provisions covering adverse effects arising from the Brexit vote in their conditionality being included. But again, I think that I describe that as the exception rather than the rule. Now, you'll obviously also need to think about how you anticipate Brexit in any new contracts that you want to enter into. There are two points here which come to mind. The first is triggers for application of security and other financial covenants, asking yourselves whether those triggers are appropriate and whether they would need to be changed in the event that UK insurance regulation changed post-Brexit. In other words, whether those triggers would have to be aligned with the new legislation. And the second point is just simply around restructuring for Brexit, the issues that I was talking about on the previous slide, and whether either contracting party would need some flexibility to take account of restructuring which might be undertaken. There may well be other points which would need to be considered, but hopefully those two give you sort of flavour for the sort of things which may need to be considered. One of the impacts that we've noticed for life insurers is an indirect impact of the Brexit vote, which is the impact of lower interest rates. Lower interest rates means that guarantees available to policyholders, like guaranteed annuity rates or guaranteed investment returns under policy terms, have become more expensive, which has led sometimes, I think, to think about their options and the sort of things which might be considered by firms who have an issue with the fact that the guarantees offered to their policyholders have become more expensive. Have to look at things like whether the original policy terms can be enforced in a situation where perhaps you're being a bit more generous than the strict contractual terms actually say, and whether the policy terms permit any amendments. There's also the possibility of restructuring the long-term insurance business to hive off parts of the business to which guarantees apply into a separate sub-fund so that the additional cost of guarantees does not affect other business within the long-term insurance fund. And then finally, there is always the possibility of compromising guarantees under a scheme of arrangement under which policyholders would agree to give up their guarantees in return for an uplift to policy values. So a range of issues there that we think that life insurance businesses may need to consider. I'm going to hand over to John Gilbert now, who is going to talk about mutual deferred shares.
Thank you very much, Charles. When we first thought about putting this webinar together in July following the Brexit vote on the 23rd of June, I thought we would be spending 2 minutes on mutual deferred shares, saying that the legislation had been passed in early 2015. We were waiting for regulations to emerge from the Treasury. They hadn't emerged in well over a year, and with Brexit on their agenda, the Treasury would probably be have other things to occupy their minds rather than producing the regulations on mutual deferred shares. It was therefore quite a pleasant surprise to find in August this year, without any fanfare or announcement, that the regulations or draft regulations were published together with the Treasury consultation paper on the implementation of the Act. And that is a very positive move, I think, for the sector. This is possibly the biggest development that we've had for a number of years for the mutual sector. And it's positive also that the consultation takes an extremely optimistic tone. It's looking for implementation of the regulations by the end of this year, so that mutual deferred shares might be issued as early as 2017. And that optimistic tone is echoed in the recent FCA consultation on mutual deferred shares, which was published last week. So it might be helpful just to recap and run through the story so far, how we got to where we are. The Mutual Deferred Shares Act started life as a private member's bill in the House of Lords, introduced by Lord Naseby, who many in the sector will know as the former chairman of the Tunbridge Wells Equitable Friendly Society. It was a piece of enabling legislation, a very short Act of Parliament, running to just a couple of pages, which, like most private members' bills, didn't really stand much of a chance of becoming law unless it was adopted by the government and given government time. And here there's a little bit of a Brexit twist, because the Treasury Minister, who was in charge of taking it over and giving it government time, was Andrea Leadsom, one of the most prominent Brexiteers and aspirant Prime Minister. So with her support, or perhaps despite her support, depending on your political views, it passed through Parliament with all-party support and received the Royal Assent in March last year. What followed from that was a series of discussions between an industry working group and the Treasury, the PRA, the FCA, HMRC, and representatives of various other government departments, which came to a bit of a abrupt end at the end of September last year. We saw some preliminary draft regulations around Christmas time, commented on those, and then everything fell silent until, as I say, we had this rather welcome news of the consultation paper and the draft regulations in August. So looking at the... we seem to have skipped two slides. Can we go back? That's it. Looking at the framework set by the Mutual Deferred Shares Act, as I say, it's a very short piece of legislation, but these features were set in stone for the regulations to add some flesh to, and they are that the shares should be available to friendly societies and what's defined in the Act as mutual insurers, which boils down to companies limited by guarantee. There's an interesting little point to that as well, in that the first reading of the Act was of an Act with a much wider scope that allowed not only mutual insurers but also cooperatives and housing associations to issue deferred shares. But in our discussions with Mrs. Leadsom, she was very anxious to ensure that the Act that was passed by Parliament was an Act which was going to be used, and she wasn't convinced that those non-insurance entities needed the power to issue deferred shares. So she wanted to concentrate the legislation on something that would be of use and would be a good use, therefore, of Parliament's time in passing it. Another feature prescribed by the Act is that the shares should be permanent capital, i.e. they should be capable of being transferred but not capable of being redeemed. The Act mentions that although they're called shares, they are not shares for the purposes of Companies Act, and therefore all the provisions relating to the issue of shares under those acts won't apply. And there was a desire also in the framework set by Parliament to preserve mutuality, and that has two manifestations. The first in that the holders of shares, irrespective of how many shares they hold, will only have one vote. And indeed, if they happen to be members of the mutual by virtue of being a policyholder, they won't get an extra vote through their holding of mutual deferred shares. The other and perhaps more wide-ranging point is that there should be no voting rights for holders of deferred shares on amalgamations and transfers, and that is intended to prevent them voting in favour of a demutualisation, virtually taking over the mutual, outvoting the policyholder members and turning it into a PLC or other private company. So that was the framework. It's useful, I think, just to look at some of the flesh which has been put onto those bones. And the first point to note is that issuers are presented with a choice between issuing what are called ordinary deferred shares or preference deferred shares, which correspond to restricted or unrestricted Tier 1 owned funds under the Solvency II regime. Shares must be one or the other. This isn't a feature of the legislation, but therefore it's no longer going to be possible, if these regulations are enacted in their current form, to have anything other than Tier 1 owned funds. That's not to say that a non-Solvency II insurer, a non-directive insurer, cannot issue shares, but they must have the features of Tier 1 capital. Once that choice has been made between preference or ordinary mutual deferred shares, then as the regulation stands at the moment, the issuer is stuck with it. It's not possible, once you've issued ordinary shares, to issue preference shares, or vice versa. Having issued preference shares, it's not possible to issue ordinary shares at any time in the future, as the regulation stands at the moment. The consultation document shows that there may be some flexibility on that point, and that may be a point that respondent to the consultation, which by the way is open until the end of September, may want to make. Another feature is the segregation between members and policyholders' funds. This presupposes that there should be a Project Chrysalis exercise under the rules made by the FCA a couple of years ago to allow mutuals to recognise what's referred to as members' capital. But the drafting of the regulations is a little unclear on this. It talks in terms of providing for the segregation of funds rather than imposing a clear obligation to segregate them. So it leaves it open that the offer document and maybe the mutuals consultation should say, constitution should say that the shares will not be remunerated out of policyholders' funds without actually going through a formal segregation. A third point is that dividends should be payable from distributable items, which is defined by reference to Section 830 of the Companies Act. As a matter of drafting, the regulations don't import the remainder of the section or of the chapter on the Companies Act on distributable reserves, and that leaves a little bit of a question mark about whether that will be implied into the terms of issue. And of course a question mark also in as much as that chapter of the Companies Act talks quite extensively about shares, whether the mutual deferred shares, which are not shares for the purpose of the Companies Act, are included. There's also a question mark there about the position of friendly societies, for which the concept of distributable reserves is an entirely foreign concept, and how exactly that will play out if Section 830 of the Companies Act applies to them without any further to do. Moving on to the most recent consultation from the FCA, this was a chapter in their regular quarterly consultation which came out at the beginning of September. The FCA expressed concerns about the sale of these shares to unsophisticated retail investors and effectively is proposing to import the regime which it set up for building society, called capital deferred shares, to mutual deferred shares, which means that sales to sophisticated investors and professional investors will be permitted, but there will be a very stringent health warning that needs to be issued to any retail investor who might consider buying these instruments. The consultation on that closes on the 2nd of November. So looking at where that takes us to, there are quite a number of uncertainties left by the Treasury consultation in particular. There's a great deal of uncertainty over the taxation of mutual deferred shares. The mutuals at the moment benefit from a exemption from corporation tax on their surpluses because of the concept of a mutual being trading between its members, and one can't trade with oneself and make a profit from oneself. The consultation opens the fear that a mutual that issues shares might lose that exemption because it's generating a profit with which to remunerate the shareholders. That I think needs bottoming out and greater certainty before there's going to be much enthusiasm to issue these shares. There's the uncertainty I've mentioned already about friendly society issuers. The Act gives the regulations the possibility of making amendments to the Friendly Societies Act amongst other primary legislation. That opportunity hasn't been taken. There are a number of aspects of the Friendly Societies Act which would require amendment to allow mutual deferred shares to be issued by friendly societies. There is some uncertainty over shareholders' voting rights as well. Charles has already mentioned the possibility of a scheme of arrangement. As the regulation stands at the moment, shareholders wouldn't have the right to participate in any scheme of arrangement entered into by a company which has issued a company limited by guarantee which has issued deferred shares, even though that that scheme of arrangement may have nothing to do with the demutualization. There is uncertainty which the consultation document acknowledges over costs. They've put a cost figure of £100,000 for the issue of shares. That seems a little low, particularly if an issuer needs to go through a Project Chrysalis restructuring in order to issue the shares. And finally, there is some uncertainty over the timing. The optimistic tone of the consultation is looking for December, but I think there's quite a lot of work that needs to be done to refine the regulations before that can happen. So is a very quick run-through of where we are on deferred shares. As I say, the consultation, the main consultation ends in the end of February, the end of September, and we will see where we get to with the Treasury on the responses to the consultation. And on that, I'll hand over to Jonathan.
Thanks, John. I'm just going to close our webinar today by talking a little bit about some recent developments in M&A in the mutual insurance sector. And I'll touch on three main areas. First, I'll just talk a little bit about some recent market trends we're seeing with mergers and acquisitions activity involving mutuals. I'll then discuss a few points that have come up on recent transactions we've been involved in, or which we think are going to be relevant for transactions in the sector going forward. And in particular, I'll talk here a little bit about the impact of Solvency II and what we think that's likely to be. And I'll comment on some of the latest developments for transfers of engagements and Part 7s. So thinking a little bit about recent market trends first, looking at the insurance sector as a whole, the last few years have clearly been an extremely busy period for M&A with high volume of transactions across the entire value spectrum. And at a global level, I think there's various factors that are clearly driving this. I think we're seeing things like pressure in the reinsurance agreement industry, a desire to get access to Lloyd's, new buyers coming into the market, for instance, from the Far East, and also just firms generally trying to focus more on core activities and, by extension, disposing of any non-core businesses. At least in the UK, I think there's also continued to be a lot of activity involving broking and distribution businesses, and technology is clearly one factor that is playing a part here as insurers look to buy in expertise and think about new ways to deliver services. But it's clear that changes in the regulatory framework for selling insurance products are also playing their part. But against that backdrop, I think activity involving UK mutuals over the last couple of years can be seen as falling into three main sort of groups. The first is a continuation in what I've described on the slide as mergers which aim to secure the position of the transfer society members while at the same time expanding and diversifying the recipient firm's business. Two examples here would be Marine and General's transfer to Scottish Friendly, which completed in June last year, and then Teachers' merger with LV, which completed in June of this year. In both of these examples, the transferring with profits business has been allocated to a separate ring fence with profits fund so that the policyholders are insulated from the experience of other parts of the business. And at the same time, the transferring policyholders get the benefit of pre-agreed administration costs and potentially in the last resort access to a larger pool of assets. The transferring policyholders also benefit from the sale of potentially things like illiquid asset investments and business infrastructure, and in the long term they may well get a fairer distribution of assets over the course of the runoff of the fund. At the same time, on the flip side, the transferee gets the benefit of the administration fees on the business and also access to a new customer base. I think at a high level, the structure of these deals is largely unchanged from the demutualisation structures which were developed at the height of the demutualisation of the late 1990s, early 2000s. The transfer scheme will typically contain a number of provisions designed to prevent leakage of value from the transferred business, and governance arrangements will be put in place to ensure that the interests of transferring policyholders are taken into account. I think we've certainly seen some changes in approach in recent transactions. For example, using the existing with profits committee to provide governance protection for transferring policyholders rather than setting up a bespoke committee. However, in many respects, these transactions have remained largely the same. The second category, I think I flagged on the slide, is acquisitions designed to build growth in key strategic areas. So we've seen a few deals of this nature, and one example here would be Leeds Mutual's acquisition of Abacus Limited, which completed earlier this year, and I think that reflected Leeds Mutual's strategy of building its existing military affinity. And similarly, Wesleyan's acquisition of DPAS Limited, which completed at the end of last year, and that obviously increases Wesleyan's position in the dental market as a provider of dental membership plans, and also expands the range of dental products that it's able to offer going forwards. And the third category we've identified on the slide are transactions designed to secure the capital, well, improve the capital position of the mutual and improve returns for members. And I think just one example of here would be Equitable Life's disposal of the remaining part of its non-profit annuity business to Canada Life, which completed in February of this year. So against that backdrop, I'm now going to consider in the next few slides the impact of Solvency II for M&A in the sector. Of course, a key gating issue here is whether Solvency II applies to both buyer and seller at all. I think certain smaller firms obviously may fall outside Solvency II entirely. And just to remind you of the relevant provisions here, this would be the case if their annual gross written premium was not greater than €5 million. The firm's technical provisions, gross of reinsurance, were not greater than €25 million, and also that they were not part of the group with technical provisions greater than €25 million. And finally, they had no significant reinsurance operations. But where Solvency II does apply, I think one thing we're going to see is the higher capital requirements imposed by Solvency II is going to result in insurance companies, you know, reconsidering their business models. And on a similar note, the so-called diversification benefit also works against businesses with only one line of business or businesses that are sufficiently have sufficient scale. In terms of other drivers of M&A arising from Solvency II, we pick out probably the increased disclosure of public information and the consequences of breach of capital requirements. And I'll also talk a little bit about the new prudent investor rule introduced by Solvency II, although I think our view is that in itself this has not led to a change in investments held by many insurance companies, at least not so far. So turning to the new public disclosure requirements first, the scope of information which firms are required to disclose under Solvency II clearly represents a large step on from the previous regime. And we set out some of the key material which firms will in due course be required to make public on this slide. The overall theme, however, is that lots of information which firms were formerly able to keep private and in the context of an M&A transaction only released at a very late stage in the transaction, perhaps to a single preferred bidder, will be available to everyone. But just to pick out some examples from the slide, the amount of a firm's SCR will be publicly available, unlike the ICA. There'll be much greater and more easily accessible detail about the firm's governance systems. And firms are also going to have to disclose a lot more information about the structure, quality and amount of their own funds. I think it's important to flag that significant information can remain private. For example, details about a firm's risk appetite and capital policy. However, it's clear that the dynamics of M&A transactions are clearly going to change as a result of the increased information that will be available to everyone. I think we'd expect an impact on pricing from that. Sticking out the last point there, probably I think the most significant change here is the separate disclosure of any capital add-on imposed by the regulator. This will be a requirement in the UK for Solvency II firms from the 1st of January 2018. And will effectively disclose the firm's ICG position, and of course from that any issues that the firm that the regulator has with the firm's business. This is likely to be a very powerful weapon, I think, for the regulator, and could encourage a flight to more well-regarded firms by consumers. But turning to the next slide, the other side of the increase in public disclosure requirements under Solvency II is the changes to the regulatory consequences for firms which breach their capital requirements, and in particular their SVR. We've summarised on the slide the main aspects of the regulatory requirements which apply in the event of breach of SVR. In particular, I should pull out the requirement for a firm to notify the regulator when it observes that the SVR has been breached or might be breached in the next 3 months. And secondly, the requirement to submit a realistic recovery plan to the regulator within 2 months. This is a much more defined process from what existed previously, with much clearer triggers and time periods. I think there's also less scope for the regulator to extend or delay intervention. It's quite clearly limited on that front. I think we think this is an important point, as the requirement on regulators to take action, I think, is likely to lead to more companies being pitched into an M&A process because they have inadequate capital resources, or alternatively having to close the new business altogether. And then finally, turning to investments, the rules relating to investments held by insurance companies have also obviously changed significantly as a result of Solvency II. And key changes identified on the slide, removing the requirement to invest only in specified categories of admissible assets, removing asset and counterparty exposure limits, and finally the introduction of a new prudent person principle to all assets with capital charges for different asset classes. In terms of the effect these changes will have on firms' investment policies, we're currently, I think, doubtful about whether they'll make that much difference, particularly given the capital weights applied to certain assets. Changes in investment strategy have probably really been a trend since the financial crisis, with insurance companies investing in things like infrastructure, loan portfolios, commercial real estate, debt. It's possible, though, I think, that the matching adjustment will encourage firms firms to invest in certain assets such as infrastructure, which obviously provide long-term income streams which can be used to match annuity outflows. In an M&A context, we think these changes are likely to have implications for buyers when they come to carry out due diligence, and I think they're going to have to think, you know, much more closely about the structure of, you know, target or target's investment portfolios. For example, to understand the structure of more complex assets and to confirm that the buyer itself is satisfied with the suitability of the assets. And there may also be additional regulatory implications, for example, confirming that any assets that have been structured to benefit from matching adjustment approval will continue to do so after the transaction has been implemented. But to finish off, the final area we thought would be helpful to comment on are some recent developments in the context of transfers of a business, since obviously the mechanism for merging two mutuals or transferring a bit of business is most often going to be a transfer of engagements or a Part 7. And in particular, we thought it would be helpful to flag some recent areas that the regulators have been focusing on when considering these transfers. And some of these flow from a joint update the PRA and FCA gave on Part 7s in May, and others from some recent transactions we've been working on. So I listed out 5 points on the slide. The first point we wanted to raise is in relation to the type of work which the independent actuary or IE will need to carry out to complete his assessment. I think one point of emphasis that flowed from the regulator's update in May was that while the PRA did not expect IEs to determine a firm's capital requirements from first principles in order to assess a transfer, they did expect to see a rigorous challenge from the IE. What does that actually mean? Well, I think it's going to involve an assessment by the IE of the methodology and assumptions which the firm has been using to calculate its own capital requirements. And there are various approaches an IE might take here. It might involve him doing perhaps detailed checks of the firm's own approach and then doing some benchmarking alongside that perhaps. Or it might just involve doing high-level checks but then perhaps applying some mildly serious stresses to see whether the capital requirements are still covered. Whatever the approach that particular IEs choose to take, however, it's clear that firms are going to need to be ready to explain and justify their own actuarial methodology and assumptions. I don't think firms should be surprised going forward if an independent actuary seems to be straying into grounds that might historically have been considered BAU actuarial matters. Second part we flagged there is to do with the independence of the IE and potential conflicts of interest involving the IE. I think what we've seen here is that the regulators are increasingly focused on the position of the firm as a whole, of the actuary firm as a whole, as much as on the individual's personal position. And I think the regulator is definitely scrutinising closely the work being done elsewhere by practice for the firms involved in a transfer. I think firms just need to bear this in mind when engaging actuarial practices generally, so that they don't actually limit their options if they're planning any future, you know, Part 7s or transfers of engagement, just if they have an available actuary. Third was around amendment provisions. This, I think, has been a particular issue for regulators on some of the recent transfers we've been working on. And it may not seem like a big concern at points in time that a transfer is undertaken, but I think it's something that transferees need to make sure they are focused on so they don't create any issues themselves further down the line. The focus the regulators push has been really, I think, on limiting the scope of amendment provisions to situations where an amendment is absolutely necessary in order to enable a business to continue to be managed, cutting back, I think, the firm's discretion to make other changes that might be desirable and indeed advantageous for all concerned. And firms just want to, I just think we're just suggesting that firms bear that in mind when they think about, when they interact with regulators and think about the terms of the scheme documents they're putting together. And a similar point comes up in relation to governance structures and just thinking about how you resolve conflicts and conflicts of interest between different groups of policyholders going forward. This is partly perhaps a sort of output of the trend I mentioned earlier towards with-profits committees taking on additional roles in respect of particular policyholder groups rather than a new committee being set up. That approach clearly obviously saves costs, but it does mean there may be circumstances where a committee has to weigh up conflicting interests of different groups. And putting in place provisions from the outset, I think, is one area where firms can address that type of problem early on before a transfer is implemented. And then finally, it's quite a recent one that we've seen with the regulators. It flows out of the decision that was given by the High Court at the end of last year in re-excess insurance. And this was a case that involved the interpretation of a particular guarantee in the context of Part 7 and the legal advice obtained regarding the interpretation of that guarantee. And this was important because it was material to the conclusion which the IE reached about the effect of the scheme. Because of the materiality of the guarantee in that case and the advice, the court considered that it would have been appropriate for the legal advice to have been disclosed to the court by being annexed to the independent expert's report. I think the facts in that case are very clearly very specific, and we'd look to distinguish them as far as possible on other transfers. But I think it's clear from our recent interactions with the regulators, this is a point that they're very focused on, and there's definitely been a trend in asking for material legal advice and materials to be disclosed both to the court and to the IE. I think the takeaway for firms there is just really thinking carefully about how legal advice is used and shared, just so they can avoid being put under pressure to release materials that they prefer not to in due course.
Well, thank you, John and Jonathan. We hope you found our webinar interesting and helpful. If you have any questions, please do feel free to contact any of us. And with that, we'll sign off.